the podcast with everything paranormal. It's the 222 Paranormal Podcast, starring your host, Joe Shortridge.
Hello.
And his sister.
Hello.
Hello. What's up, Joe?
Oh, my God. I'm so tired.
Did you just wake up?
Yeah. I recorded a video, a live video last night, and it sucked. It was terrible. I redid it.
Did one person watch?
Yeah.
Your stalker?
That's why I do it so late at night, because nobody can watch. But I redid it, put it up on YouTube, and it's already out on our page.
All right. Everybody better listen. Yeah. Go and watch it.
I talked about the Phantom Social Workers.
Phantom of the Opera?
No.
Oh.
Do you know why he wears a mask? Because half his face was ripped off by monkeys. Did you know that?
The Phantom of the Opera? Really, really, I know. This is what I deal with all the time. Yes, I don't know why for like the last week I've been like obsessed with Phantom of the Opera.
I don't know.
I don't know why.
I don't know.
I got to tell you about my dream last night. And then I got to update everybody on my ghost situation.
Oh, really?
Okay, so I had the weirdest dream last night. I was in the ocean and it was like the Arctic Ocean, but the water was warm and there was a dead whale upside down. What does that mean?
Was his feet up?
No, oh. he was just dead and he was upside down and I was like clinging to him. And then
you
there was
to a dead whale.
Yeah. But
okay,
I like.
Okay, dream interpreters.
What does that mean? There was a giant iceberg too, but the water wasn't cold. And then all of a sudden the oceans are getting really rocky and I was getting overwhelmed by the water. And then I was in like an elevator with him.
Him?
This guy right here.
Was the elevator upside down?
Dead? No, it was like we were going into one of those, those things where you get. I forget, I don't know what the name of it, but they put you inside and you try to like solve mysteries to get out. But then when
escape room?
Yeah, that's it. And so you and I were in the elevator with some other guy, and I don't know who he was. And the elevator was a closet, but
she's
then
talking about Christopher Tillman, who's sitting waiting patiently.
My crazy dream. So we get down, and the elevator went into this basement, and then it was like an episode of Saw, that movie Saw. Like, and it was really scary because I was trying to escape and.
So the whale represents your abundance of turmoil.
Okay.
The iceberg represents the cold meaning of time that you don't
cold-hearted
have.
Cold-hearted players out there that break my heart.
Oh, yeah. Australian pilots.
All right. And I'll tell you my ghost story real quick, and then we'll get into the show.
We'll introduce Christopher, who's sitting here patiently.
I know. He's so patient. My craziness. Okay, so I went to bed Thursday night and I'm having trouble sleeping. I can't sleep at all. I'm like having anxiety and can't sleep. So I finally fall asleep. You know that moment right before you fall asleep and you're just like so relaxed and you're just about to fall asleep. All of a sudden I get that feeling, that tingly somebody is staring at me feeling. And it's like 2:30 in the morning and I look up and there is... I thought it was my eyes, like, you know how you get like squiggles in your eyes, and it was like Predator, you know how it's just like the outline.
The shimmer?
Like it was like a shape of a person standing over my bed on the left side, no, the right side, and I closed my eyes and blinked, and it was there, and it turned its head and looked at me like that, and I freaked out, and I turned the light on.
The Predator is watching you.
It scared me so bad because it was that weird feeling that, I don't know if you guys have experienced that, like somebody standing, like, you know, that's your body's natural instinct when somebody's like staring at you from across the room and you feel them staring, or somebody's right behind you. And
I don't know. I thought you were going to say that just before you fell asleep, you got that shake that that everybody has. I forget what they call it, but where you get that shake all the time.
Oh my God, I get that all the time. Oh, I just spiked. But yeah, that happens all the time when you're falling asleep and you feel like you're falling off the sidewalk or... Uh-huh. Off a cliff, and then you wake up. Yeah, I got that. No, it was weird.
But that shimmering thing.
I had scared. I didn't want to go in that bedroom last night.
There's a story about in Lima, Ohio, this girl, her husband's one of the famous speakers on the circuit, but she was in a tree stand, and she looked across the trees and actually saw that shimmering in the trees and took pictures of it, but, you know, you can't really tell in a photo. And... she said it actually went from tree to tree.
That's so weird.
So that shimmering effect is a common phenomenon that people see.
But this was clearly a shape of a person. I couldn't tell if it was man or woman. felt male. But it just turned its head like that. Oh my God. I couldn't sleep then.
It's your guardian angel.
Well, it's weird because I was trying before that, earlier in the night, I couldn't sleep. So I was taking photos in my bedroom. I'm like, maybe I'll capture something. And I just got pictures of my hot pink walls. But yeah. All right.
If I did that, I'd get tons of orbs because my house is so dusty right now.
Yeah, I know. You know how I feel about orbs. Chris and I are going to argue about orbs here in a minute. No, just kidding. All right.
So patiently sitting here, we have Christopher Tillman from Haunted Toledo.
How you doing?
Hi. You just come to listen to our stories.
I could go on and on, but I won't.
It sounds like she has a predator in her bedroom.
It was scary. I could see it through it, but I could see the outline. It was kind of like watery. I don't know. But then I thought, okay, maybe it's just, you know, how you get like your something squiggles in your eyes or something. I blinked and it was still there. Okay. So anyways, Joe, just give a background of what's going on here.
So from last week. As you know, we did a show a couple weeks ago called The Church of Satan. And in that show, we kind of skipped over or breezed past a murder that occurred here in Toledo. It was a murder of a nun in a chapel on April 5th, 1980. And a lot of people don't know the backstory of it and stuff. So we're thinking, and we did get some responses from our show asking us to dig deeper into the murder. So we got a hold of Christopher Tillman from Haunted Toledo, and he is our resident historian. Basically the best historian in Toledo.
He's a legend among men. So, you know, Chris, I know you have opened up the vault into your files, and I know you have some really great information about this case that you've been, sitting on for a while. So let's talk about what exactly happened with the murder of this nun and how it all ties into our show about the church, about the Satanists in Toledo in 1980s.
1980, yeah. It was April 5th, 1980 that she was murdered. Father Robinson was the, he was assigned to the chapel at Mercy Hospital, and Sister Paul was assigned there. She was like the caretaker. She would take care of, you know, the deeds of the chapel, and she would attend to the people that were visiting family and that would stop in and pray and whatnot. There's a lot of stories about Robinson was a really nice guy, and then there's stories that he had like a unchecked temper, and he never wanted to cross him or anything. But that's all, and it's
hearsay.
It's all people
gossip,
right?
Rumors.
But the basics of the murder is that on April 5th, there were two officers that were in the building, and somebody came running up to him saying, "You know, there's a nun dead. There's a nun dead." And they, when they got to the chapel, as they were running to the chapel, there was another priest and Father Robinson that heard the commotion, and they ran with him to the chapel. And they get in there and they find this body on the floor. It's covered in a sheet, which turned out to be one of the altar cloths from the chapel. I mean, it was a horrible scene, really grisly. She was, they pulled the sheet back. They could tell that the way her body was positioned, the way her clothes were, that it appeared that she had been assaulted sexually.
Okay.
But they never, I mean, this is 1980, so
yeah,
they never had the full proof if she was or not. But they found that she had been strangled, and she had been stabbed 31 times.
Okay.
9 of those were in the shape of a inverted cross. And the detectives, when, I mean, you gotta figure 31 times, you're going to hit the same spot a few times, and it might look like. But the detectives on the scene, they did say in their reports that these inverted crosses looked intentional. 4 days later, Robinson presides over her funeral. Mm-hmm. And about, I think it was 2 weeks later, that he was called in to the police to talk about his relationship with her and for them to, you know, to get more information on what might have happened to her or who might have done it. Robinson, it appears he was having trouble in the interrogation. He did offer up that he had heard the confession of the man who did it.
Okay.
But because of the custom that, you know, the confession remains
anonymous
and secret,
and
it can't be included in court and all that, he refused to give any information who might have done it or who the person was. Then, interestingly enough, a deputy chief at the time with Toledo Police, Ray Vetter, he was a practicing Catholic. And he allowed the Monsignor for that district to come in and remove Robinson from the interrogation room, which kind of ticked a lot of people off.
Yeah, I'd imagine it would.
He allowed the interrogation to be interrupted, and he let him leave the building. And then the same deputy chief went around to all the detectives that were helping with the case, asked for their notes on the case, asked for their reports on the case, pretty much took all that information from them and kept it to himself. And now to this day, there are reports that are still missing. So that led a lot of people, including Dean Andros, who prosecuted the case 2004, 2005, 2006. There's files missing. And that leads a lot of people to believe that because of the deputy chief being a Catholic, and at the time there was an unspoken relationship between the cops and the church that if the priest did something wrong, just send him to the bishop and let the church take care of it.
Yeah, that's a common thing. But
right.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of claims of cover-ups and conspiracies and things like that. So he pretty much went, I mean, a lot of cops suspected him of doing it. They just never had the evidence to charge him. And so he went a very long time without ever having to face, you know, what happened.
How long was it between when the murder occurred and then when the actual court case started?
26 years? About 26 years?
It's
see, it was 1980 when the murder happened and the trial was in like 2006.
Right.
They
reopened the case in 2003.
Oh, okay.
So he got to live with that for quite a long time. What led them to reopen the case was the police got a letter from someone. They never released her name. They call her Survivor Doe.
Okay.
And they got this letter from her where she was claiming that she had been ritualistically abused by a cult in this area, and that Robinson was, he may not have been a member, but he was participating in it.
Okay.
And whatever was in that letter, they decided to go ahead and let's reopen this case, mm-hmm. not necessarily to prove for a cult, but maybe there's something in here that they can get Robinson on. And for the longest time, he had a letter opener shaped like a sword.
Yeah.
And they picked that up in 1980. And, you know, blood evidence being what it was back then, there really wasn't much they could do with it. But they pulled that out of evidence. They exhumed Sister Paul's body. And mm-hmm. they realized that, you know, some of those stab marks I think one of the detectives said that it's like fitting a key into a lock.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a perfect match.
Okay. See, I heard that they found that. I thought they found it in 2003 or 2006. Yeah. I thought they found it then, but they actually found it back when the murder occurred.
And they just held on to it. It was in his apartment, in his desk.
Are any of these records like public that we'd be able to access?
I don't know.
I'm just wondering if they noted or reported any markings on his hands. Because typically when you have a violent murder like that, at some point you mm-hmm. may or may, you know, not have struggle
marks or
cuts to yourself with that much violence going into.
Yeah, I mean, they would look for clothing with blood splatter and stuff, but, you know, back in 1980, I don't know, because the DNA testing wasn't that great and all that.
Well, they did find blood underneath her fingernails. Mm-hmm. And when they finally were able to bring him to trial, they had it tested, and it turned out it belonged to a male, but mm-hmm. not to Robinson.
Okay.
That is a interesting.
And so
that would make sense too, though, if they did do a ritualistic killing, there would be more than one person there. So
you would think,
yeah,
or that Robinson really was telling the truth that he didn't do it.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a lot of speculation, and when the Survivor Doe stepped forward, that started the whole thing about, you know, is this a cult? You know, because we do have a history of that in this town,
mm-hmm.
and that really got a lot of people speculating, and the media just never ran with it. The cops ignored it.
Would think if it was a murder just for somebody to murder somebody, assault them and murder them, you know, one or two stab marks would suffice.
Right. This was anger.
This is rage.
Yeah.
And then guilt, because they covered the body up with the altar cloth. So that has some significant meaning to it for somebody to...
Right.
not want to either look at the victim or as a, maybe a reverence thing. So
they found blood.
The key, kind of a key.
They found her blood smeared on her forehead, which had them thinking that maybe someone gave her the last rites.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean,
whether it be the Catholic version or the satanic version, who knows, right. But
I mean, there's a lot with this case that could go either way, that mm-hmm. he did do it or he didn't do it, or it was a cult thing. I mean, I don't think anybody's ever really going to know.
Yeah.
Were there any, I don't know, in the 80s, was there any video camera, security camera type thing at that time? No. Okay.
And it was a working hospital back then.
Mm-hmm.
And hospitals are 24 hours. You'd think somebody would have heard something, you know, but nobody did that we know of.
Yeah.
No. And it's, well, I mean, hospitals I've been in, when you walk past the chapel, it's usually a very small room usually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's usually there's nobody in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't know what it was like back then, but they're always kind of dimly lit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they have a very private feeling to them, and mm-hmm. they're not really.
Not like you have a lot of traffic coming in.
They're not
in
on the main drag, you know. Yeah. They're kind of off in the corner somewhere to keep, you know, from people walking by and all the commotion. But to me, it sounds like it was something triggered somebody, and they just, and this poor lady caught the brunt of it.
Yeah, but the thing is, it was on Easter Saturday, and it was a nun in a chapel, you know. So
to me,
it looks more like a planned out ritual. Ritualistic thing.
Yeah, I mean, it everything you read, it's like, well, this is just a bunch of hogwash, and then you read something else, and it's like, well, maybe.
Right. I mean, it just seems that there's more evidence that this was intentional.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, premeditated. Yeah. I want to say that's the word for it, because
it sounds like whoever killed her knew her.
Yeah.
They knew her, and it was like you said, it mm-hmm. was all about rage, and
you would have to have the weapon on you. So right. It's not like it was just laying there and it was heat of the moment type thing.
She was known to carry scissors with her for some reason.
I read that really? She, for protection.
Right. And when they saw, or when they processed the crime scene, that the scissors were gone. There were no scissors.
Hmm. Interesting.
So that could have been the murder weapon. I'm not sure why she would. I don't know. Was that what it was for protection?
Yeah, that was one of the things I read, that she would keep scissors in her pocket for protection. Now, what did she? Who did she need protection from? So, if that's the case, then you have had dealings with somebody who led you to.
But you could also think too, being a working hospital, there's a lot of different types of people. Maybe she had that feeling that, you know, a lot of people coming and going. You don't know who you're going to deal with.
It was the 80s. Yeah, but it did say that the detective used the scissors. If you know. They used it as a murder weapon, it would surprisingly fit right into the stab wound in her jaw.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. It's such an interesting case. Like, and is that chapel still around?
No, I think at Mercy Hospital. So I'm not sure if that became the children's hospital or if that became a different branch.
Right now what it is a nursing school. But I'm just wondering if the chapel still exists.
It probably does. Yeah. Just either if...
But you would think if something like that happened to it, would they, you know, close it down and create a new one? Or,
I see what you mean,
Or just keep it as a working, you know.
Well, let's go over there.
All right, let's go. But, you know, the interesting thing is, you would think that, you know, when Robinson was convicted and he went to jail, you half wonder if he had any, like, prison confessions or maybe wrote a journal or something like that. I wonder if that exists out there somewhere.
It looks like he pretty much kept to himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the time he went to court, that was also the big time for the church, you know, the priest sex scandals and mm-hmm. stuff was going on. So he was, he might have been protected in the beginning, but once all this other stuff came out,
mm-hmm.
He was seen probably as a liability, and the church wouldn't even pay his legal fees. He had to have...
Court-appointed?
I wouldn't say fans of his, but
supporters.
Mm-hmm. They I think they raised almost $250,000 for his defense.
Okay.
But I remember watching the news shows. He didn't really seem to be very talkative. He wasn't very
He would
active.
Just sit there.
Yeah.
He seemed very frail.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't think he would have, even in prison, I don't think he would have told anybody if he did it, or it doesn't even seem like he told people he was innocent. Mm-hmm. He just.
Yeah. Don't you think if you didn't have anything to do with it, but your conviction led you to keep it, you know, that sacristy, you know, private, you would say, I didn't do it, but.
Yeah, but
you know, I took a confession, or you know,
the oath of confession. To,
right.
Yeah, you can't force him to tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
No, he just seemed like he was accepting what was going on. He really didn't have anything to say for or against, so it's kind of hard to say.
Do you think he was like modeling himself after Jesus and sacrificing himself?
I don't know if I'd go that.
Yeah,
far,
I don't. But. It just seemed to me like you were just saying, he just sat there and accepted what happened to him because it's the oath of the confession that he's not going to say anything.
So he was found guilty on May 11th of 2006, and it was only the second conviction of a homicide of a Catholic priest in the United States. The first one was Hans Schmidt, who was executed in 1916. So that's like, you know, a very, I don't know what you would call it. I lost my train of thought. But high profile,
yeah,
you know, thing to go through. Being only one of two cases in the United States.
Right.
So what do you think of like the cult connection part of it?
It's you know, you really want to go there because I love a good conspiracy anyway.
Yeah.
So it's like you really want to hope there's a connection. And it looks like there might be.
Okay.
Survivor Doe, in her letter, the letter that helped them ultimately convict him, she also goes on to say and make these claims. She filed a civil suit against Robinson,
okay,
which kept getting thrown out because of statute of limitations. And her lawyer had a pretty good argument as to why it should be valid, because she didn't realize that Robinson was one of the men who abused her until she saw his face on TV when he was in the courtroom.
Okay.
And so her lawyer was saying that the statute, that's when the statute starts. When you recognize one of your abusers.
Wow. Yeah.
And the court was saying, no, it starts the day it happened or whatever. So there's like and they took it all over to the Ohio Supreme Court, and they just keep getting it thrown out, which adds fuel to the fire that there's a cover up and everything else.
Yeah, but, exactly.
It's more stuff you have to dig through. But her claim was that Robinson was a part of a cult here in town called the Sisters of Assumed Mary.
Okay.
And this was I'm not even sure you could call it a cult. It was just a bunch of guys who would get together. They would dress up as nuns, and they would call each other by women's names, and they would add Jerry to the end of it. So like Carrie Jerry or Mary Jerry. And it was just guys that were into nun culture or something.
Okay.
It sounds like it was more of a party thing than it was an actual religious thing. But she claims that that is the group that ritually abused her. She has a history of being abused by family, and claims that her mother eventually gave her up to this cult, and they continued the abuse, and that's Robinson was a part of that. And that's how she claims that when she saw him on TV, that she, all these memories started coming back.
Hmm.
Now this cult does exist, and the guy that started it claims it's a party thing. It's just about guys getting together, dressing up as nuns.
Everyday thing.
And this woman does have. It seems that she may have been abused. I don't know, but she does seem to also have some mental issues, because she claims she's being stalked by the man that started this cult, and that he drives past her house all the time.
Okay.
And the problem with that is that this guy doesn't have a car.
All right.
So, again, you're going back and forth with. So it sounds like maybe she was abused, but maybe she's not dealt with it or had appropriate psychiatric care over it or whatever. And so there's more questions than answers.
That goes into the gang stalking thing, where everything they see, they say, look, there's another person stalking me, or, you know.
You think about a red car, now you see him.
Exactly.
All over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So you're thinking, okay, so it's just a bunch of weirdos that dress up as nuns, and this lady has a issue. Mm-hmm. But then you go back in history, and Toledo does have some evidence of satanic activity.
Yeah.
Well, like we put on our Facebook page the letter that we found from Dr. Sloan confirming that he was
involved
Satanism since he was age 3, and he did have a lodge here in Toledo. They call it a lodge. I don't know if it was just a store or whatever it was. I don't think we had any pictures of it.
No, but it's tore down now.
Yeah. But so, you know, that's documented evidence right there that, you know, he was he large in the church or high up?
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, he started that in, what, 48? And then when he died, it pretty much died with him. But there's really no way of knowing if he had any followers.
Yeah.
And if he did, how many.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these occult groups, they'll really embellish their followers. They'll embellish their history. They all want to want to seem older than they really are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The thing about it's Lady of Endor Coven or whatever it was called.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that really points to activity here in Toledo, I know from the 90s that I've met a lot of practicing Satanists. So I know these cults are out there. The majority of these people follow LaVey's Satanic Bible, which is really, it has nothing to do with ritual sacrifice. It's just a bunch of people getting together and, doing kinky things with each other. That's all it is. But there are some people that would seem to, if you give them the right push, they're going to fall into that other category.
Yeah.
And a lot of people growing up and don't know this, and some people have forgotten it, but in 85, we did have the 80s were all about the satanic panic. It was everywhere. And 1980 is pretty much when it all started. And it started gaining ground with animal mutilations and ritual sacrifices and people stealing babies and black candles and everything. 84, 85, it kind of hit the zenith. 85, summer of 85, Richard Ramirez scared the hell out of people in Southern California, sneaking into their houses at night. And he would kill them and then mutilate the bodies, you know. And then he would, you know, put pentagrams over the walls and write things in their blood on the walls. He scared the hell out of Southern California. And he was an avid Satanist. There's a famous picture of him in going into the courtroom where he drew a pentagram on his palm and just held it up for the camera. A lot of people have seen that one.
Yeah.
He even reached out to Anton LaVey, the Church of Satan founder, and LaVey just didn't want nothing to do with him. So yeah, 85 was a big year for this stuff. And then also Monclova, I'm not sure if it was Monclova then, but out in that area, they had gotten reports of ritual sacrifices going on there since the 70s.
Mm.
It's got an interesting twist. That story leads all the way back to San Francisco and the counterculture. All right, so 66, 65, Haight-Ashbury is this big thing. There's a bunch of hippies there, long hair, they're bad smelling, they're smoking dope, they're protesting anything, you know, that crosses their mind. And that draws in a bunch of the weirdos with the strange religious beliefs, and they want to build their cults and everything. 66, LaVey starts Church of Satan. And then that draws even more people in. The Process Church showed up there. They started in London. A couple former Scientologists thought they could do better. Married couple, Robert and married to Grimston. They bounced around all over the place. They go to New York, New Orleans, Chicago. They go to San Francisco, and they open up an office there, which was two blocks away from where Manson was staying. So there are a lot of weird connections with the counterculture. It's a great thing to study. They try to get on the good side with LaVey. He shuns them too. LaVey is if you don't know him, he's a really interesting character. He's a former lion tamer with the circus. He's a former crime scene photographer. He played the old Wurlitzer organs at the burlesque houses.
Yeah.
This guy
I read that about him.
Really?
He is just he's a showman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why a lot of people think his Church of Satan thing was just...
Wasn't he trying to get into movies and Hollywood kind of shunned him?
No, he was the spokesman. He was a consultant for Rosemary's Baby. And when they offer the baby up to Satan at the end of the movie, he plays Satan.
That's right.
Interesting.
So, I mean,
Monty did some acting.
A lot of people just look at him as being, because all his philosophy for that church, it comes from Ayn Rand. There's no religion to it. Mm-hmm. He's on record in an interview saying that the devil doesn't exist. This is not anti-Christian. It's not, it's mm-hmm. just, this is a whole new, this is like a religion for people that don't like religion, basically. But he's basically a showman, and this is how he made his, he created his own job. This is what he was doing. But he did have a lot of people that, when they saw he was like that, they said, no, you know, Satan's real. So they went off and started their own cult, and he had a lot of followers that branched off and did their own thing. And the Grimstons with the Process Church were kind of one of them. But they never really took hold like he did. So they got a weird philosophy. Robert, when you look at pictures of him from the time, he mm-hmm. really wanted to make himself look more like to be Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought he was Jesus. And Mary was like, she was the one trying to get the converts coming in while mm-hmm. he was over the side preaching. And he got dissatisfied with it and went back to London and lived a quiet life. And she went underground to restructure the group. Now, there's a retired captain with the Tiffin Police Department who studied all these cult movements, who believes that Mary came to Toledo in the mid-70s.
I thought I read that. And she had something to do with Dr. Sloan, didn't she?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you have to assume they crossed paths at least a few times.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, those people seek each other out mm-hmm. on a regular basis. But she always went by the name Cersei in San Francisco. And so he claims that when she showed up to town in the 70s, it seems to coincide with the opening of an occult store by a woman named Cersei. And a lot of people think that that is the same Cersei that mm-hmm. we all know, the nurse, and she had the home on Parkwood and everything. And I don't think it's the same person. The things just don't line up with their mm-hmm. histories. But there's also a claim that this same woman, Mary, that went by Cersei and a few other names, also bought a tract of land out, you know, by the Monclova area. Mm. Now, June 85, they get contacted, the police get contacted, and with people that claim that they were witness to satanic sacrifices and rituals on this tract of land out there in Monclova area.
Mm-hmm.
And so June 85, they did a two-day dig. And James Telb was the guy in charge of it. And Telb even came out and said that he believes up to 80 people.
Oh my God.
For I think 15 years prior were killed there. Now, a lot of people will say that lived in that time and say, oh, they found a bunch of junk. And that out there in that area, people didn't always, at the time, they burned their trash mm-hmm. out there. And so whatever didn't burn, they just buried. And that's they dug it up, and that's what they found. But according to what Lucas County Sheriff's found, they turned up a headless doll with nails driven through its feet and a pentagram attached to one of its arms.
Oh.
Mm, no, you hadn't heard that.
Yeah. That doesn't sound like
yeah.
someone just burying trash.
Right.
They also found a 9-foot wooden cross. They found sacks of folded children's clothing, 60 male children's left shoes only. No right shoes, just the left ones. 60 okay. of them. They found an assortment of hatchets and knives, and they also found an anatomy dissection book. They never found any evidence that there were bodies buried there. This is only just weird stuff they found buried there. No evidence of any murders there. But this guy, this Tiffin police captain, he says that at the same time they broke ground to start digging this stuff up, and it was coming out that they were finding weird stuff.
Okay.
This occult shop that this mysterious Cersei opened suddenly closed.
Wow.
And they have no idea where she went. So the connection that mm-hmm. they want people to make is that this woman was somehow involved
in it. Yeah.
And it's been going around lately that this Cersei married to Grimston, if that was her, is the same Cersei that people know here in town. And I just don't believe it is.
Well, you'd have to almost line up the ages, you know, right. Like she'd probably be in her late 90s by now, if that was the same person. Because
I can't remember Cersei's real name here, but she's passed away.
Okay.
But her history just, she was a very open person. She was always in the papers.
What did she practice?
Witchcraft
or yeah, she claimed to be a witch.
Right, but there's more to it than that. They always have, like, you know, they always got some weird way of describing it. I'm not just a witch. I'm a Celtic Irish.
Yeah.
So I don't really know what she was into.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I know that's the type of stuff that she gravitated towards. Yeah. And the people I've talked to about her says that there's no way that they could be the same person.
Okay.
There's just no way. Mm-hmm. And it does look like that might be the case. And I'm not sure how popular of a magical name that Circe might be. But
it might be.
In that circle, it might be a name that everyone wants to call themselves.
Right. So, I mean, it's possible. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was a huge deal. I mean, when the news broke that the sheriffs were out there dedicating all these resources to dig stuff up, it had Time came to town, mm-hmm. Newsweek came to town, mm-hmm. all the big networks came to town. It was
National Enquirer ran a huge story about it.
It put Toledo on the map, and then it just kind of fizzled and went away. And that leads people to believe, oh, it's another conspiracy. They found something, and now they got to bury it again.
Yeah.
So it's all kinds of weird little things that are going on that you don't have all the evidence, but you got just enough to make that leap. And one of the things they want to do is say that Robinson and other people in his group were somehow involved with what went on with that dig and the stuff that was put there. I've never been able to find out how they made that connection, but it's like, I guess when people say, well, he's a suspected Satanist and he got Satanists over here.
Yeah.
They must be connected somehow. And that's not always the case.
Well, you know, subcultures, it's such a small group that if you hear inklings, I'm sure somehow it's got...
Oh, they're going to know each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, like minds seek like minds. But, you know, having a nun who is a religious woman have inverted crosses on her body intentionally, you know, that link right there, you know, just opens the floodgates of like, what is really going on? Now, do you think there's still these type of subcultures in Toledo or around the area? Well, I'm sure they're everywhere, but, you know.
I think Toledo, for some reason, has always been like a hub for stuff like this.
Yeah. For a lot of different things.
Yeah, for the mob, you know, for paranormal stuff. I just think that Toledo, for some reason...
Do you think it's because of just the physical intersection of the expressways? You know, we're kind of like in the heart through the turnpike and I-75,
right.
You know, where these two come together, almost making a cross, if you think about it, you know,
and then you even got, this is the same reason why Toledo was a big port for bootlegging, is because we're a straight shot right to Canada.
Yeah.
I mean, all those things play a role. And before the highway system, I think Toledo was considered to be like a suburb of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a really good reason why we seem to be at the center. We just seem to collect this weirdness. And it's fun for me, but...
Well, you figure like Chicago, Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Detroit. Well, Detroit's a little closer, but we're pretty much right in the middle of all those.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
cities. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, being on the water, too. You know, quick escapes. Well,
when I was talking to Lou Hebert at the Toledo Police Museum, and I asked him, you know, why, you know, Pretty Boy Floyd was here knocking off banks and Dillinger was in town
for
a little bit.
My grandpa actually arrested Dillinger at one point.
That would be sweet. It'd be sweet to have that photo.
We have, I think my mom might have something. So I'll get with you. Get with you on that.
Well, I asked him.
You know what's interesting too? Just on a weird rabbit hole.
Rabbit hole.
When we were going through, we found a box of stuff that was my grandpa's. We found his badge. And in his wallet, we had his wallet. There was a card from Los Angeles. Something about a accommodation from the mayor of Los Angeles. We had no idea that he even was in Los Angeles.
Wow.
He was a Golden Gloves boxer. He used to spar with Jack Dempsey. Isn't that interesting? He was a sparring partner.
One of the guys that fought Dempsey turned out was hired by the Licavolis as an enforcer.
It's like 6 degrees between Tillman and Shortridge. But yeah, it's just interesting, you know, like I know every city and every town has stories and backstories, but there's just so much in our area.
Toledo's a lot of crossover to major events.
Yeah.
A lot of crossover.
So interesting.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like we should. We're just, it's not like we're LA or.
We're a small city. Yeah. But, you know, even like in your research when you were down at the Commodore, like the famous people that stayed there, Elvis, right? Yeah. Was Elvis. Who was the other big one?
Bob Hope was there. Mm-hmm. And, President Truman was there. Was a guest there.
Yeah. Just interesting. But, I just, you know, I think about that every once in a while. Like, you know, we hear these stories about strange and unusual things that happened. And, you know, I want to say in the 80s it was a different time, but it was a different time. You know, it's like we don't have all this modern equipment of every cameras everywhere. So you probably could get away with a lot more stuff. So, you know, it's almost like people have to go more underground if they want to be in this subculture type culture, because there's cameras everywhere and people are videotaping everything.
Yeah.
And eventually something's going to come out, you right. know.
So eventually Robinson did go to court, did go to jail.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Anything after that come out?
No,
so the case kind of just fizzled off?
Yeah, once they had him convicted, they just they figured it was case closed. The cult activity, I think it might have sold one paper. You know, maybe had a few viewers on the news, but they never really pursued it. I don't think they took Survivor Doe, her claims. I don't think they took them very seriously.
Did any other witnesses come forward that said that happened to her? Because like a lot of times, somebody come forward, somebody else will come forward.
Not on the news.
Okay.
But there was, you hear chatter online and stuff like that, but it's like,
what do you believe?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Unless you have evidence.
Until you go to the police with it, it's mm-hmm. it's just talk.
Yeah. Because I know you get the trolls on the internet that just want to, they don't have no clue what they're talking about, but they want to get into that because it's the cool thing to mm-hmm. get into the, you know.
To be a part of it. Yeah.
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 So it's tough because, like you said, I know you have resources that a lot of people don't have. So you can actually go in the police stations and look at the records and stuff and not rely on what you see on the internet, because 90% of the stuff on the internet is just people out there putting stuff out that don't really know what they're talking about.
Right. Or they get a few facts
mm-hmm.
Mixed up, and that can send you off in the wrong direction sure. instantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There also have been, I mean, the connections between Robinson and the dig in 85 and then going back to Lady Vendor, they're not substantial enough
yeah.
to really say that there is a connection.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, even in this field, everybody knows who everybody else. Everybody
yeah.
knows what's going on with everybody mm-hmm. else. It's just, you have to assume that they at least knew of each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I feel that he may not have done it, but he may have been in that group that dressed up like nuns and all that. So, like you said, he knows what went on, and maybe it was a confessional thing. And by looking at his demeanor in court, net, you almost can tell that he just sat there and took what came to him just because of that confessional,
right.
you know?
And, you know, I don't remember what he passed away from. I think he had heart ailments, but he wanted to come back to Toledo, and they wouldn't let him.
He had a heart attack.
Yeah, he wanted to come back to Toledo to die, but he did, and he ended up passing away in 2014 in a hospice down near Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so just a, you know.
It's a very interesting case. Like we said, it was only the second case of a priest getting arrested, and happened right here in Toledo. But yeah, death of a nun in a chapel on Easter Saturday, ritualistically, mm-hmm. and then covered with the cloth.
Have you ever had any backlash of when you're investigating legends and the history of Toledo like you do? Have you ever had anything people maybe approach you or come to you and say, don't open that can of worms, or you better watch what you're digging into, or anything like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're getting roadblocked with research into the Bone House.
Okay.
Asking questions about Santeria. And Sarah is getting, the people that she knows have answers.
Mm-hmm.
She's getting real, I mean, they will not talk to her, but they want to know everything about her.
Yeah.
And then, you do get that, like, you're not supposed to know about this stuff. It's not for you to know. I get that a lot with Native American stuff. When I go looking at their stuff, mm-hmm. I have a friend in Oklahoma, and she's part Native. And I'll call her and ask her and say, you know, is this smudging stuff? What is this crap? You know, or what's the turkey feather for? You know, mm-hmm. And so she'll answer all these questions from a completely native perspective and not some book that a white person wrote.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then there are questions too, like she'll say, you know, that's not for you to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know, you got to respect it. That's just their.
Yeah.
And then there's also stuff where you're talking about, well, the yacht club is another one.
Mm-hmm.
I know damn well they were running booze out of the yacht club. Yeah. I just know it. It's prohibition.
And like, what's it matter now? It's been like, what, almost 100 years? You know, it's like, so what? That's a part of our history.
I remember talking to the historian at the yacht club, and he would not entertain that story. Every mm-hmm. story he told was very positive and uplifting. And
yeah.
And it's like, come on.
But, you know, and we've talked about the yacht club before where the location is perfect.
All right.
The everything, so you know they were, but like Jen said, doesn't really matter anymore. You know,
yeah. I mean, I think Al Capone's tunnels in Chicago. Joe and I went there, and you know they were very open. Yeah, he did his business out of this building, yeah. And you know they're running booze up to Detroit from mm-hmm. Canada to lead. You know, it's like,
but
is what it is.
But the owners of the historian of the yacht club, maybe he just feels that it's not something that they want to talk about, and that's okay. You know, yeah. It's okay not to talk about stuff,
right?
You know. So what's anything exciting on the agenda for Haunted Toledo?
Yes, what's going on?
Yeah.
A lot of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, there's so much stuff that you guys are working on. And
yeah.
It's just...
We admire that.
There's some great videos going to be coming out.
Yeah.
We have some great stories coming up this year. And I'm hoping we can reveal more information about the church we were at.
Mm-hmm.
We have to meet with them, I think, next week. And we're going to give them, let them hear some of the weird... audio that recorded. Then there's a huge story coming after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we're all going to meet again inside the Bone House.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And we're going to go over
so
the audio with the homeowner,
mm-hmm.
let you guys hear it and broadcast right inside the yeah. living room.
So I'm looking forward to it. So excited.
So a reveal on today's show.
Mm-hmm.
Stay tuned for all of us at the Bone House.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, you guys are doing a great job.
That's a whole nother thing. Very interesting.
I know. It's time to get in some ghostly places, Joe. It's been too long.
Yeah, we haven't ghost hunted in so long.
Yep. Not since the prison. But, yeah. So, you know, Chris, we appreciate you coming in today and sharing your story with us. And, you know, you're welcome back anytime. There's a million stories we need to tell, and we'll tell them together.
Thank you for having me.
You guys, if you want some really great, great video stories, information, yeah. Go to Haunted Toledo's website. Where can they find you? I can't talk today.
HauntedToledo.com is kind of like where we just post the bulletins of what we're doing. But the Facebook page is like we really go in depth with the fans about mm-hmm. where we're going, what we're finding.
Yeah, and didn't you guys hit a nice milestone?
10,000.
That's amazing.
10,000.
Yeah. I was kind of worried about announcing it because it's like 10,016. And so you go check and it's like 10,015. I'm like, crap. We just announced 10,000 and we're going to dip below.
Yeah.
So, but it's just never expected that. Yeah. And they're all people from this area.
That's
so.
Amazing. Yeah. That's great. Joe and I strive to get there. It took us a long time to get to 1,000.
Yeah. So everybody listen to this show.
Yes.
Tell all your friends to like
share,
our page. Please like our page.
Share our page. Share Haunted Toledo's page, too, because they do good work.
And if you're in the area or at any of the conventions, come up to our booth and we'll introduce you if they are in the room. So
autographs for everybody.
So, yeah. So let's leave our show. Thank you for stopping by, Christopher. Yes. You're always welcome in the studio.
Thank you.
And let's leave with some... Murder in Ohio by 60 Second Crush. Tune in next week for another great show, and thanks for listening.
Peace out, everybody.
Bye-bye.